You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Trudy Truitt.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Trudy Truitt on the show with me today. She's got a phenomenal new book. It's called Explorer Academy, The Star Dunes. This is book four in this phenomenal series. Trudy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Trudy, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, wow. When I was in the second grade, I started writing stories, ghost stories in particular. I'm not quite sure why, but they seemed to fascinate me. And I would write them. And I remember my teacher, she was a first-year teacher. Her name was Miss Gustafson. And she would say, Trudy, I like this story, but your penmanship is leaving a little to be desired. And so that was my first memory and memory of revision, when I had to write my story again so that she would put it up on the board. And really, honestly, from then, I've always been writing stories. I just love it.
Oh, that's amazing. Do you remember if there was an adult, either a parent or Miss Gustafson, who recognized this storytelling gene in you?
I was really fortunate. I had my mom and my dad were really supportive of me as a kid, and, you know, letting me, I used to have an imaginary friend, which I'm sure probably scared my mother, you know, to no end that I was talking to things that weren't there. But my parents were wonderful supporters of me, and I had so many teachers in elementary school that were so supportive of what I did. In particular, my fourth grade teacher really impacted me, and maybe that's why I write for middle grades today. Mrs. Zielinski used to let me write plays, and I would put the plays on in front of the class. So I would gather my friends at recess, we would practice the plays at recess, and then we would put them on in front of the class. And sometimes, on occasion, she would let us put them on in front of the whole school. And I think that was really the time when I said to myself, this is, words are powerful things, you know, plays are powerful things, and this is what I want to do with my life. In some manner, shape, or form, I always knew that I wanted to write.
I love that so much. I ask people those kinds of questions because As writers, there are some pretty dark and lonely days when you're working the craft, and where it seems like it's just you and a computer in a room, and, you know, is this ever going to mean anything? Is this ever going to accomplish anything? And invariably, there's almost always a memory that we can pull back on where someone noticed something in us and gave us encouragement. And those little pieces of encouragement have fueled so many people through some of the, the darkest times. And I encourage people to look for that in other people.
Yeah, that's really true. Writing is, especially if you put your heart out there for people to read, it is it is not for the faint of heart. There's lots of rejection in writing. And I think, you know, people will ask me, you know, what is the secret to success? And I will, you know, it's not necessarily talent. It's perseverance. It's just being willing to continue to take constructive criticism when you get it, and to keep going and keep honing your skill, and continuing to do what you do because you have to do it and you're just called to do it. And eventually, it will, you know, it will pay off, but it does take time and, energy and effort and encouragement from those that, that you love and trust along the way.
Right. Trudy, I read in your bio, I think it was, that you have a degree in broadcast journalism, and that you were actually a TV news reporter and weather forecaster. Tell me about that path, about you going that direction.
Yeah, well, you know, that was kind of my thing when I decided as a kid that I wanted to be a writer. And then I started exploring all the ways that you could be a writer. And when I was in junior high, middle school, we had a newspaper, and my newspaper advisor at that time, I said, you know, I think I might want to be a reporter. And he said, well, what are you waiting for? And he said, we have a newspaper in town, you know, and I said, but I'm 12. And he said, but you can still write. And so I walked into the newspaper office and I said, I think you should have a column for teenagers and I will write it. And they said, oh, okay, sure. And that kind of really started my path into journalism. When I got into college, I majored in broadcasting and decided that I really enjoyed video and TV news. But at the time, when you got out of school, you had to start at a very small station. So I went to a little teeny tiny station in eastern Washington and started reporting and doing pretty much everything. When you start in a small station, you're a reporter, you're the editor, you're the producer. And I got roped into doing weather forecasting. And so I had to really quickly learn how to do weather forecasting. And one thing that I found when I did the weather was that one of the perks of it was that you went and you talked to school kids about the weather. So I would travel around and talk to the kids about the weather. And I thought, you know, they ask such great questions. And they're so interested in meteorology that it would be really fun to write a weather book for kids. And so I wrote a book for kids on weather, and I shopped it around to all these different nonfiction publishers, and every one of them said, no, thank you. Except Scholastic said, we do nonfiction library books. Would you be interested in writing in our format 4 or 5 weather books? And I said, sure. And that's how I started writing nonfiction. When I finished the weather books, they asked me to do earth science, and then I was doing animal books, and then health books, and holiday, and along the way, I started publishing my fiction, too, so I kind of was doing everything, fiction and nonfiction, and it's funny when you write how one door opens, you know, you walk down a path, and another door opens, and you walk down, you look back, you go, wow, I have come quite a ways, and I'm not even sure how each door opened, but as long as you keep writing, something will open up for you. So, and that's really how I got the gig with National Geographic. They heard that I wrote both fiction and nonfiction, and came to me and asked me to write a story that combined both together.
Well, you know, holding your new book, you know, Star Dunes, first off, what a gorgeous book this is. When you open it, the full color, you know, paintings, I mean, it's just, it's a magnificently done book, presentation and all. You know, but you look at that and go, man, I would like to do what Trudy does. I'm going to try to jump in where she is, and not knowing you know, the path that you took. I love those stories so much because, you know, life is an adventure, and you just never know what doors are going to open to where. You just have to kind of be open to the journey, don't you?
You do, and recognize that sometimes you think you're taking steps back, aren't necessarily steps back at all. They're just, you know, wait and see. And the important thing is that you don't give up. And I've sort of watched other people along the way get discouraged and say, well, you know, if I can't go, if this doesn't happen, then by such and such a date. I've sort of learned not to do that. And don't put any time limits on yourself or deadlines on yourself. Just let life take you where it takes you, and you will end up where you should be.
Right. Well, you mentioned that that National Geographic really took a liking to your work because you wrote fiction and nonfiction, both in an engaging way. What is it about writing nonfiction for, especially for middle graders, that because, you know, that is a fickle audience, let me tell you. You know, they are I'm not saying they're difficult to write for, but you really have to grab them. You have to grab their imagination, even in nonfiction. So what are some of the things that you picked up along the way that have helped you to connect to this audience?
Well, I think one of the things I realize about kids is that, and you might have done this when you were a kid too, if you find a topic that you love, then you immerse yourself in it. And I will see kids who are 9, 10, 11 years old, if they, like if a boy finds a topic they like volcanoes, he will read everything about volcanoes he possibly can read. And so as a writer of nonfiction, my job, I always felt, was to try to find weird, unusual, unique, interesting things that reader might not know about volcanoes, so that it really made my book stand out. It really gave them something new and interesting to read. And so when I write fiction and I have combined the nonfiction, I've kind of tried to do that same sort of thing, is to, I think that's what makes it interesting. That's what gives it that lively edge that engages the reader, that keeps them turning the pages, is when you can share something really unique. And kids love that. They're little sponges. I mean, they just absorb all kinds of knowledge. And they're also very good at being honest about what they like and what they don't like. So if you write a book that's very textbookish, you're just not going to capture them. And that's my job. That's my goal, is to have them open a book, keep turning the pages, and want to keep turning the pages, regardless of whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction. It's always your goal. And actually, fiction is pretty, I think nonfiction is pretty exciting to write, because there are some amazing stories out there. And as a reporter, you know, it was just a matter of putting them on the page, finding that person that had a unique and interesting story to tell about being, say, a volcanologist, and what is it like, you know, what is a typical day like. The fiction part is harder, really, because that's where your imagination has to come into play, and you need to create something that's gripping and compelling. And I always feel more intense pressure to do that.
Right. So the Explorer Academy, the series that you're writing for National Geographic, you began it with book one, was The Nebulous Secret. Tell me how this relationship formed between you and National Geographic, and what was the idea that sparked this collaboration?
Well, National Geographic really had the idea for Explorer Academy. They wanted to make a jump into fiction. And I think it was to reach readers in a new and different way. They're well known and well respected for nonfiction, and it was a way for them to maybe connect in a new and unique way with readers. And so for me, really the challenge was to try and figure out, you know, they actually just let me run with it. They said, this is what we want to do, Explore Academy. We want kids from all over the world to come together and to travel the world. Okay, Trudy, go. And you get to determine how that story goes. So I'm really fortunate because they didn't, you know, micromanage me or try to make me put something into a story that didn't really fit. They let me find my own way and my own style in dealing with, in dealing with a fiction story like that. So I'm really, you know, grateful to be able to just, because the story has to come first. It's the adventure that just has to come first, beyond the nonfiction that you're trying to weave into it.
Right. So what's the premise behind the Explorer Academy? Who are these people, these kids, and what sort of adventures are they on?
So the Academy is an elite school where kids from all over the world come together, and they head out from Washington, D.C. So the first book has them training together, and they learn about, you know, what they are required to do as explorers. And then from there, the second book has them traveling throughout the world. And so they head off to, they go up the eastern seaboard and head to Iceland. And along the way, they find that there are some whales in trouble who have been caught in fishing nets. And so they stop and help the whales in fishing nets using some very state-of-the-art technology that doesn't really exist these days. So that's kind of a good example of how you can marry the nonfiction of the reality of what we face in our seas and waters with trying to solve a problem. So they do this around the globe. They go and they learn about, you know, pollution, species extinction, climate change, overfishing, all of those things. And yet it's also at the same time, there is an action-adventure element of it too.
We talked a few minutes ago about this sort of fickle audience that you have, that you're writing for, and the Explorer Academy series of books really deals with some serious issues, and that you enumerated, several of them just a second ago, but these are things that that we're all concerned about and that we all want to learn more about. And you know, what we can do to help. But this audience, when you're talking about middle graders and you know, into young adults, the last thing they want is to be, taught at or, you know,
exactly.
Preached at with some right. sort of moral, ecological message. How do you make sure that you're getting the information across while keeping them engaged and, you know, they're learning stuff without knowing they're learning stuff?
Well, you know, I try to write it the way I would want to read it. And ultimately, the story has to come first. So it's got to be, Cruz has got to be a character you like. The adventure has to be exciting. The villain has to be mean. And you take the plot first and you say, this is where I want the story to go. This is the adventure I want them to take. And then everything else is kind of gravy. So the learning part comes when they're in class. So they go and they, you know, sit down in class and their professor teaches a lesson. But maybe instead of reading out of the textbook or, you know, watching a movie, the professor has like a holographic video of a giant saber-toothed tiger jumping out at them. So and all of a sudden they're learning about saber-toothed tigers, and you don't overwhelm them with it. You just do something unexpected, something unique, something fun, and you drop in a few facts, and then you keep the story going. And I think when you do that, if the story's always coming first, then you're never really preaching or trying to get a message across. You're just letting the explorers live their life. And if you do that, then you can pack a lot of stuff in there.
When you're writing a book series based around earth science, there can't be a better organization to partner with than the National Geographic Society. What has it been like working with them and having all of their resources at your disposal?
Oh my gosh, it's been really amazing. I've been able to, you know, talk to explorers around the world. I've been able to, you know, read articles, connect with the explorers, and then just the people who work on the book with me, the art department and my editors. It's, you know, they're just all so gracious and professional and giving. It's really an, I have to say, it's really an honor and a pleasure to work on this. And you don't always get that as a writer. You don't always get that support. You don't always get that, you know, you don't always feel the love. But fortunately, with this group of people, they are, you know, even people from the, even the marketing department, the sales department, everybody has to be invested in you. Otherwise, you know, you're only as good as your weakest link when it comes to, you know, creating a book. And you've got to have an art department that cares about the illustrations and an editor that cares about the storyline and a marketing and sales department that care about getting that product out there and getting that book out there. And they have to love it as much as you do. And often as a writer, you don't find that those people love it as much as you do. But I am really fortunate that that National Geographic has given me such wonderful support.
So let's talk about the planning process of a book like The Star Dunes. How does, from kind of walk us through from concept to turning in, are you a detailed outliner? Like, how do you come up with the plot points, and what does the planning process of a book like this look like?
Yeah, so what I originally did was when I knew that the National Geographic had told me they wanted a 7-book series, and so that's sort of how I plotted things out. I told myself where I wanted the characters to go in each book and what I pretty much wanted them to accomplish in the beginning, in the middle, the end. And then as I have written each book, I have plotted it out in a little more detail. So I sort of, I will do a synopsis of here's where Cruz goes, here's what they learn, here's where the villain shows up, this is what happens. But I don't plot or outline extensively. So at the beginning of each book, I'll probably do maybe 6 or 7 page outline of kind of where I want things to go, because I know myself and I know that I can plot really detailed and then I will immediately deviate and it will be totally useless. So I try to do just sort of general outline of where I want things to go. But because for me, the characters really dictate where the story goes. And I have learned this lesson time and time again. I keep relearning it. And that is, I will try to make a character do something that they just will not want to do. It can be because that's not in their nature. They're not in their personality. And so what I've learned is let the characters drive the story. And that way, if you do that, it's also fresh for you, because you wake up every day, you sit down to write. I don't know always what's going to come out. And I'll give you a good example. When I first started writing, I was writing Cruz's best friend, Emmett. And Emmett was coming across kind of whiny. And I was, you know, I had written the first few pages. And I was like, you know, I just do not like you, Emmett. And so I said, Emmett, let's start you over. You know, and I did. I went back. And you have to kind of deliberately see things, look for things that are not working for you, and redo, revise, fix them. And he was a good example of that. And I mean, because he was a likable kid, I wanted to make him a likable kid. And, you know, having him whine too much was not helping things along. So you've got to find those things and correct them. But I just try to kind of let the story flow every day. I know where I want the series to end, which is good. And then everything in between, we just sort of let the pages fill in each day.
You know, that anecdote about Emmett that you just shared, I think that's something that a lot of young writers struggle with, is mm-hmm. holding their writing too precious. There never needs to be a time where you can't go back over a page and cut what needs to be cut or reinvent a character, because it's all necessary.
And the hard part, I will say too, is, you know, when your editor makes a comment, it's really easy to be defensive. I have two editors on this series, and the one thing that I've learned is that a good editor is there to make your work better. And so, you know, what I had to do, and I'm revising right now, so you have to put your pride away and say, now wait a minute, this comment, while meaning I have to now rewrite 3 pages, or changes things. Maybe my editor has a point here. And I tell you, every time I do that, my work gets better. When I stop and actually listen to what they say and rewrite it, make it better, instead of just saying, oh, it's fine, it always improves my work, always. But it's hard to do that sometimes. It's hard to go back and say, I didn't give it my best. This isn't quite right. This isn't quite working. And when an editor tells you this isn't quite working, you need to listen to that and work it better, because your first idea is not as good as your second idea, which is not as good as your third idea, which is not as good as your fourth idea, kind of thing. So
that's a great point. That's a great point. Mm-hmm. Trudy, do you ever look at the news? And you know, as we're recording this, we're kind of in the midst of this corona virus, COVID-19, blow up here in the United States. Do you ever look at the news and see something that's going on and go, man, I wonder what the Academy would do about this?
Well, interesting you should say that. In the Star Dunes, the characters, the explorers, learn about viruses that are transmitted between animals and humans. And it wasn't something that I really, I certainly didn't anticipate where we are today when I wrote that. But, you know, yeah, I think that is the beauty of writing realistic fiction. As much as I enjoy magic and fantasy, but, you know, we're not going to be wizards. We are scientists. We are explorers. We are researchers. There's so much that, like I said, I'm always overwhelmed by the amount of material that the explorers offer, and it is amazing to me. And I try to think about too, how would children deal with the issues that we face? You know, what would they do that would be different than adults? I think kids are very resilient. They're very optimistic. They're very hopeful. And they're always looking for ways to make a difference. That's what I notice about children. And that's why I love writing for them, is they have, you know, incredible potential. And adults, we're very used to making excuses about, you know, why we can't fix this or why we can't do that. And kids, they don't really do that. If they see something that needs to be, they see a pond that needs cleaning up, they will clean it up. You know, if they see something, they see a need in their neighborhood, they will work to meet it. And I think that's something we can really learn from children, is just they put the excuses away and they just contribute.
Well, the book is called The Star Dunes. It's book 4 in the Explorer Academy series. Trudy, we've got links to the book in the show notes of this episode where everyone can grab their copy.
That's amazing.
If people are just learning about you and all the great stuff that you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
You bet. You can go to truditruitt.com. It's T-R-U-D-I-T-R-U-E-I-T. And you can read all about my books and Explorer Academy and get the latest scoop and links there at my website.
Excellent. Be sure to link that up so it's easy for everyone to find. Trudy, this has been so much fun talking. I love the books, love the series. We're going to recommend it to everyone. Thank you so much for taking time.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great. It was really great fun to talk the writing process. I could do this all day.
Absolutely. Love it. Love it. Trudy, have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course, wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app? He thought.
Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this? You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc. Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night, and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked. You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen. The robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to
it... Some things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from...
Plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?
He asked the mysterious caller. You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you?
He asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.